Some musicians are born into greatness, others earn it. Vuafar Couture has done both. On Tuesday, September 29th, the Winnipeg Folk Festival welcomes acclaimed Malian guitarist to the Centre Cultural Franco-Manitobain, the son of legendary desert blues pioneer Ali Farka Touré. Vu has built a remarkable career of his own, fusing the hypnotic rhythms of West Africa with blues, rock, and some of the most electrifying guitar playing you'll hear anywhere. Powerful, joyful, and completely captivating, Vuafar Couture delivers a live show that stays with you long after the final note. Here all year. Enjoy amazing music year-round and grab your tickets now through Ticketmaster.ca. Don't miss Vuafar Couture, Tuesday, September 29th at the Centre Culturel Franco-Manitobain. Brought to you by the Winnipeg Folk Festival and proudly supported by 101.5 UMFM.
Good evening and welcome to Art World Innovators, exploring stories of innovation in the art world. I'm your host, Susan Cohn, and you're listening to UMFM 101.5 at the University of Manitoba.
Our guest this evening is Amy Dempsey, art historian and best-selling author, born in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and currently based in London, England. Amy earned a BA in psychology from the University of Virginia in the U.S., an MA in art history from Hunter College in New York, an MA in modern art history, and a PhD in art history from the Cordell Institute of Art in London. Amy's early career in the arts included working at commercial galleries in Washington, D.C. and New York, writing for various museums in London, such as the Tate, the Victoria and Albert Museum, and the National Maritime Museum in London. A fellow of the Royal Society of Arts, Amy is the author of The Female Body in Art, published this year, the international bestsellers Styles, Schools, and Movements, The Essential Encyclopedic Guide to Modern Art, published in 2002, currently being updated, The Groundbreaking Destination Art in 2011, and more. Her books have been published nationally and internationally by leading publishing houses such as Hames & Hudson and in numerous languages. Amy continues to contribute articles and essays to numerous exhibition catalogs and arts magazines. She's been invited to many lectures to speak at various events, has been frequently interviewed in various countries for the general public, experts, and children. Welcome to Art World Innovators, and thank you so much for joining us this evening.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
As an independent scholar with a track record of wrestling gigantic themes, your recent book entitled The Female Body in Art has been described as a thought-provoking exploration of beauty, identity, power, and resistance, and a fresh perspective on art history itself. Would you like to tell us more about this work and how it came to be?
This one was interesting because it was the first time I'd worked with a new publisher, Lawrence King, and they approached me out of the blue. And so the commissioning editor there actually had the idea. And at first I was like, "Ooh, how do I tackle such a big subject in a size that people could actually hold?" But then I got really intrigued and started thinking about it. And then eventually the best way for me that I could think of it was I thought of it like an exhibition in a book. So I could think broad theme, but then going chronologically, bringing out different stories from different periods that had interesting stories of their own. But then also you can trace kind of themes throughout and see developments. And I really liked the way, I guess that's why I like art history, the way you can find different stories and learn about different periods and different people. And also the fascinating way that it changes some of the things or don't. I mean, some of the Renaissance ones bringing out the beauty concerns and considerations are so still relevant. Beauty manuals being produced to tell you how to be thinner, get rid of body hair, all this. I was like, oh, we haven't moved on at all. Anyway, I really enjoyed that one. It was such a fun one to work on and really intriguing. And also because most of my professional work has been in modern and contemporary art, it was really interesting to dive back into some of the older stuff that I probably hadn't looked at or thought of so intently since being a student. I really enjoyed that one. So that one's still new and out there, and it's going to come out in Japanese in June, which is exciting. And they got in touch because they're going to do a special foreword for the Japanese edition explaining how, because Japan was closed for so long and it wasn't different, so they're going to put it in a Japanese context, the Western version of it. I'm really intrigued to see that part.
How do you actually select the artists and works to include and narrow it down?
That's really hard. I had PowerPoint after PowerPoint for myself kind of going, okay. And it came down to wanting to do a mixture of some that were familiar to people, so they'd feel part of it, I get this, or I'm intrigued. And I also wanted to make sure there were some new ones, because nobody wants to read the same book all the time. Some comes down to practical concerns, the picture's not available, or it's too expensive, but mostly I was narrowing it down. So again, it was trying to find ones that told really interesting stories in particular contexts, but then also could draw out more universal themes to explore.
You recently did an illustrated talk at the Tate Museum in London and joined in conversation with Carolyn Douglas, Director of Contemporary Art Society. Can you give us a few highlights of this talk and the audience response?
The highlights of this talk were, it was really interesting. It's the first time I'd done something like this. I've done a couple of talks on destination art, but it was the first time I'd done an in conversation, as it was called, and it worked really well. It made me more relaxed. The way, again, because there's so many in the book, I took pairs out that I wanted to. So we did a couple from the Renaissance, and I pulled out two that would draw out some themes. And then for that one, I really wanted to set up the good, the bad, and the ugly, if you like. So I have this one where it's from the witch hunt trials of the Hammer of Witches, and those images, again, put out in the 15th century of what hags look like, and the birth of the printing press. So that's where I could also bring in the impact of technology, which we've had again recently, that spreading ideas far and wide. So I countered that also with the beauty manuals and the Renaissance paintings that were suddenly around, and all these sculptures were suddenly being unearthed with a big building boom in Italy. So women were suddenly seeing images of idealized bodies, and the full-length mirror had been invented. So suddenly we're able to compare ourselves to it all. So I pulled out some of those along the way for each period. And then like in the 80s, Barbara Kruger and the Gorilla Girls, also some of the Groundhog Day effect of what's happening now. Some of the issues that you think are done, and then next generation, unfortunately, has to deal with them again, too. And actually, that structure seemed to work pretty well. A pair of ones that could bring out points, the bit about individual stories and these bigger, broader themes throughout. And then some interesting questions at the end, and an hour flew by. So it was really buzzy, and it felt really nice. And people came up afterwards, and everyone seemed really engaged. I think it counts as a success.
What originally drew you to writing and art?
I was one of those going to university who had no idea what I wanted to study. I find lots of things interesting. I think I took something in almost every department in the first couple of years. And then it was finally, you have to declare a major. And I was like, oh. So I ended up doing psychology because I had enough credits to finish that one and keep taking things. And then it was when, I think it was like my last semester, I took Roman art, Roman history, and Italian language. And I was kind of like, oh, it brings it all together. Art's the way in that I can do history, psychology, anthropology. So I was hooked. I did a few internships since my degree wasn't in art history. I did an internship at the Corcoran that was really interesting. The director at the time was Ned Rifkin, and he was really supportive and really nice and helpful. And he said, just go out and do it. And I was like, okay. And then went to Hunter, and that was great. And while I was going to graduate school in the evening, I worked at the Jack Shaiman Gallery during the day. So I had the hands-on contemporary art and then the art history and the academia and the commercial world. So it was really interesting. And then the writing bit came after so many years of academia. I didn't want to go straight into teaching at that point. So I thought I'd do it. Basically, writing came as that was the way I was going to do my teaching or share the ideas. And my PhD, I sent off to Thames and Hudson, that bit where you realize, oh, nobody's going to come to me. I've got to tell them I'm here somehow. And here's these cool ideas, and hopefully, and sent them out, especially pre-internet, you had to do it all. And I didn't even realize that the head office was in London. I sent it to New York, and then New York, fortunately, sent it on back to London and said she might be worth talking to. So they called me in. They said, this one's too specialized, but do you want to give this one a go? And that's the one that turned out to be Style, Schools, and Movements. So kind of in a roundabout way, but that bit where you just got to keep trying things and hope that something sticks, I guess. And as you mentioned before, as Styles, Schools, and Movement, I'm just in the middle of finishing up the new edition that'll be out next year, which will be exciting. Makes you feel old, though, when I realize that it will have been out 25 years, but constantly in print in 16 languages. So, you know, it's like that bit where you look around and go, who's that old? I can't be. I was never one of those people who knew what I wanted to be when I grow up. So I just have to keep finding my way. And then the same publisher, Thames and Hudson, that's when after Style, Schools, and Movement came out, it was that, uh-oh, what's next? And that's when I started thinking about destination art and thinking, it seems to be there's something here. With that one, as I was going, okay, great, how exciting, my first book's out. And, oh no, what do I do with the rest of my life now? I met a couple people in the 2003, this fascinating Croatian sculptor whose brother was a missionary in Tanzania, and he was going out there whenever he could and building these huge granite sculptures with help from the local community. And between them, they were building this village and turning it into a sculpture park at the same time. And I was like, wow, that's fascinating. And then through Jack Shaiman, I heard about this Canadian artist, Claude Simard, who was from a small town in La Ruche in Quebec. And he was going back to his hometown and trying to make it into a destination and to help with jobs and tourism and stuff like that. And he was doing, I loved Claude, he was great. He was doing these amazing, I mean, he was doing, you know, painting the church and putting some of his artwork around and teaching the students to talk about it and stuff. But then he was in southern India and there were these two, a church and like a temple that were being demolished to make way for a mall or a car park or something. So God knows how he bought them, had them disassembled, sent over on a ship and reassembled in this little village in northern Quebec. I was like, this is fabulous. I was like, there must be other things like this going on that are just quiet because they don't fit into a nice, neat category. Also for galleries, there's nothing to sell. So it was like, okay, I'm going to find these. I think I might be onto something. I just found it so interesting. And I also was always a fan of earth art or land art. At the time, pre-internet information, the art books just always had the old photographs from the 1970s. And there was never any mention of whether the works were still there or if you were allowed to visit them. Or so all these things were kind of like, oh, I was like, I've got to find out. So that led into destination art, which, as you know, yeah, that's definitely my baby. I love that. I want to go to all of them, but some of them are just still on the wish list.
Have you been to a lot of them before you wrote them up?
It's a mix. It's some I've been to many times because I love them. If you ever get to Nice, you have to go to the Matisse Chapel. It's gorgeous. It is just so, that one was funny because I'd written it before and then got the chance to go a couple of years ago. And I was like, oh gosh, please, please let it be as I imagined. And it was, oh, so beautiful. So yeah, it's a mixture of ones that I'd like to go to and ones I've been to. And when I was coming up with the idea of it, friends and family got dragged in as scouts and like fellow travelers. I'm like, let me know of anything cool. And things like my aunt in Iowa would send me pictures. Look what I saw. And so it was really nice. And this one is at least you can actually take with you if you wanted. The first ones were the big coffee table ones, which I'd love to do again sometime, but hopefully we'll see. See if I can talk one of the publishers into it.
You've also written a variety of monographs. Would you like to walk us through the process for researching and writing about any particular artists and what you found most exciting about that experience?
The one that I've done the most about is Alfio Banana. So he is lovely. And his sculpture park in Denmark, it was when I was researching the first destination art. And again, the internet was not useful for this much. But somewhere I saw a little mention, but they didn't have a website. But I wrote to the tourist board in this little small town in this island in Denmark, and they got back in touch. And it turns out he was the one who thought of it and got it started. And so he is really sweet. He and his wife came over to London for the book launch for Destination Art. So I met them in person. And then they would just come over once a year. And he would tell me about his projects. And I just kind of kept collecting ideas. And we became friends. My family went over to visit the sculpture park. And I opened an exhibition for him in Italy because he was doing one there in vineyards, which is cool, and one in a botanical garden. So I had all this body of knowledge, basically all his stuff, applied through various grants, and publishers want to be able to tie it to an exhibition, but you have to have the material first. But then there was a Danish museum that wanted to do a retrospective, which was great. So we were like, oh, we can get the book catalog almost ready here. So that was a really nice project to work on. Unfortunately, it was during COVID, so because I was going to go over and do a talk there, but it was my first online chat, recording a talk and sending it over, and that weird bit of my son's hold, my, I don't know, my son was about 12 at the time, trying not to giggle, and I'm like, hold it straight. So that's how that one, and then, yeah, a couple of other smaller ones or ones that have come through recommendations. The recent one on Almuth Tempelhof is a German sculptor who lives in London, and that came through, word of mouth that she'd heard that I was like sculpture and stuff like that. And then going to her studio and visiting. Those are interesting ones too. I've been very lucky to do such a range of interesting projects.
Have you published a book for children?
A family project we did, published in Italian so far, what you called Charlie Ciuffo Rosso, Charlie and the Monsters. And that came out of a project. My stepfather was Kent Harif, who was a novelist, a literary novelist. And so when we would visit my mom in Kent in Colorado, my son was there. And they used to do active stuff, horse riding and playing. But then as Kent got ill, he couldn't do any of that. And there was this really active 6-year-old. And Charlie and my husband, they've always been drawing together since they were little. So Kent would write a chapter, a little blurb, and leave it sitting out. And then Charlie would draw the drawings for it. So this kind of sat, it was just a nice family project. And then the Italian publisher of Kent's works, she and I met. How did we meet? We met because Kent's last work that was published after posthumously was Our Souls at Night. It was made into a Netflix film by Jane Fonda and Robert Redford. So, yes. So I got to go to Milan to meet the publisher. And she became friends because they come to the London Book Fair. And then again, just years later, I thought, she's nice enough. I'll show her this. Just like, isn't this sweet? And she was like, mm-mm. And then a couple of years later during COVID, she's like, let's make it into a book. So I got to help curate it and like, you know, change it from two kids' stories into this and how it would work together and what would be pictures. So that was really interesting. I suppose what other children's ones were all the stuff I did for the Maritime Museum was some really interesting projects that were to do with leadership. And they were aimed at late high school students, actually business studies originally, but showing them how not just historical figures, but how objects in a museum could teach them stuff and how to read them. And those were fascinating, again, because for me, I got to be a student again. I was learning it all. And then the bits I, since it's not my specialty, it's kind of easier to choose the stuff that's going to be interesting and relevant. So we did a really interesting one on Queen Elizabeth I, women leader of men. Ernest Shackleton, the Arctic explorer, so that was really cool, or Antarctic rather, and Horatio Nelson. So they were all really interesting, fun, decoding old paintings and what do the pearls mean and all that was, it was really good, actually, and drawing out the leadership skills of these historical figures. And it was really nice because the kids really got into it, who probably thought, what does this have to do with me? So I like when you can grab a new audience or see somebody go, maybe.
What do you hope your readers and audience will walk away with from reading your books?
Well, I hope they get excited and get as hooked, maybe not as much as me, but that would be nice. I just hope each of them captured their imagination like it does mine, because I think sometimes with each of the books, it's hard to think of different ways to say, isn't this amazing? Isn't this cool? Especially with style schools and movements. I know that the language of art history and art can be really daunting and distancing. And I came to it that way. I didn't come from an art history background or where we talked. We went to museums, but we didn't really do that. So I found it hard. So I was like, well, it doesn't need to be. We should be able to share this instead of separating and get away from the elitist attitude. So I hope it's like a helping hand and that it's also exciting. I hope some of that gets to capture some other people's imagination.
What is next for you?
In the very short term, it's getting the new version of Style Schools and Movement out. And then it's been a crazy couple of years because I was doing that and the female body in art at the same time. And then one of the monographs. So it'll be a little while of like, deep compressing, settling my son into university. So I'm not sure. Something else always pops up in between. I mean, I've had a couple artists approach me about doing something with them. It's hard getting publishers and if they think it can be. But it's one of the ones in Destination Art. I think it would be really ripe for a book. Jason Taylor does the underwater sculpture parks around the world. And he's such a great photographer. So I think that we're going to talk about ideas and see what we can scheme. So once I get my words back, I feel like I've used up my word count for the year.
Well, I'd like to thank you so much for taking the time to share your captivating story and valuable insight. It's been a pleasure speaking with you, and we wish you continued success.
Thank you so much. I've really enjoyed it.
For those of you just tuning in, you are listening to Art World Innovators on UMFM 101.5.
Tonight I would like to leave you with two songs by Blue Bloods, one of our local Winnipeg bands. The songs are entitled Burn Me Down and Looking for God on Dance Floor in Steinbach, featuring vocals by Courtney Fox.
Siente el fuego con los campeones del sonido. Thank you.
Susan Cohn, and we thank you for listening to Art World Innovators here on UMFM 101.5 at the University of Manitoba. Join us again next Wednesday from 5:30 to 6 p.m. for more on today's innovators in the art world.
On Thursday, October 1st, the Women's Songwriter Extravaganza returns to the Park Theatre, bringing together some of Manitoba's finest artists for an evening that's all about great songs and the stories behind them. Featuring Amber Rose, Brandy Vesna, Courtney Devon, Erin Propp, Isla Barker, Carrie Latimer, Rami Mays, and many more, this annual celebration showcases an incredible range of voices, styles, and perspectives, all sharing the spotlight for one special night. Get your tickets now for only $20 plus fees through ticketweb.ca. Don't miss the Women's Songwriter Extravaganza, Thursday, October 1st at the Park Theatre. Brought to you by Sure Shot Bookings and proudly supported by UMFM 101.5.
You UMFM runs on people power. Over 100 volunteers show up every week to build shows from scratch.
Hello, everybody.
Hello.
We are live, UMFM 101.5.
Choosing the music, shaping the conversations, creating something you won't hear anywhere else. No scripts, no corporate voice, just real people making real radio. And there's always room for more voices. So if you've ever thought about being on the air or being part of something creative, this is your invitation. Real radio needs real people. Visit umfm.com and join our radio family today.
In your direction.
UMFM! You guys just sit around all day, playing your music, going to your wild parties, while your grades just slip by. You're irresponsible, good-for-nothing goof-offs. I've got my eye on you.
Help us fight the evil, bitter old Dean. Listen to CJUMFM, broadcasting to the city of Winnipeg and beyond at 1200 watts.
Hey there, the Sandwich King of South St. Vitale is taking the summer off. Until he returns, here's a classic episode of Dagwood Radio to cure what ails you.
Glorious little city. Winnipeg, how are we doing on this gloomy yet calming night? My name is Connor. You have found your way to Dagwood Radio, UMFM 101.5, live from the University of Manitoba and from the heart of the campus, University Center, just down the way from degrees and IQs. Thank you so much for tuning in. I appreciate having you. Lend me those eardrums. And I guarantee to fill them up some good tunes tonight. The light is on, the sandwiches are cooking, and I can't wait for tonight's show. The first song really gets you into it, really makes you realize what the sound will be tonight. I've been watching a lot of surf stuff lately, so it's going to be some surf sounds. And I'm so excited for it. You have no idea. I've been listening to it at work. I've been listening to it on my drive to and from work. And it's a good one. I even go back to show number 4 and I pull some songs that we have not heard in a long time. So a couple, I can say it now, a couple hundred episodes ago. That's pretty amazing. So going back to show 4 for a bit of tonight, we kick things off with a group called Sunroom, a track called Sunset Garage. Out of Their Minds is the album. Maybe I should have just titled this show the Rob Nag Show.